Welcome to Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. Season 8 of Jury Duty explores the trial of Alex Murdoch, a member of one of the most powerful families in South Carolina, who is accused of murdering his son Paul and his wife Maggie, with the purpose of covering up a multitude of alleged crimes, including fraud and homicide. In our last episode, we concluded our review of the testimony offered by forensic pathologist Dr. Alan Reamer. In this installment, we begin our look at the testimonies of GM technician Devin Newell, who testifies about data extracted from Alex Murdoch's vehicle, and Roger Dale Davis, who took care of the kennels for the Murdochs at their Moselle property. That's all coming up right after the break.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It is the late morning of February 14th, 2023, day 15 of the trial of Alex Murdoch. Our last episode concluded with the departure of SLED forensic pathologist Dr. Alan Reamer from the witness stand. As we begin this installment, the prosecution calls Devin Newell. Mr. Newell appears to be in his 40s or 50s. He sports short white hair. He wears a black suit, a white button-down dress shirt, and a silver and purple striped tie. John Conrad handles the questioning for the state.
Where are you employed, sir?
General Motors.
All right. And what are your duties there at General Motors?
I'm a senior technical expert in advanced driver assist systems.
And can you just give the jury a very short version of what that entails?
I investigate field performance issues and concerns with our advanced driver assistance systems.
All right. And as part of that role, do you help maintain certain records that are kept by GM in a normal course of business?
I don't necessarily maintain those records, but I'm aware of records that we keep on servers relative to vehicle data that can be of assistance in our field performance investigations.
Okay. And when you say field performance investigations, that's something you do, correct?
That's correct.
Right. And that references generally what? What does that mean when you say field performance investigations?
Understanding how our vehicles may perform in the field. Active safety systems include things like forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking. So as we look at how those things perform in the field, vehicle data and other data we collect can be helpful in understanding what is occurring with those events, understanding how our systems are performing.
Okay. And do modern GM vehicles, under certain conditions, upload information to GM servers?
That's correct. We've got telematics units in our vehicles. That's a fancy name for sending information over the air. Those, as part of a normal course of business, those electronic modules in the vehicle collect lots of pieces of data from different sensors and modules in the vehicle, and that information can be sent via cell phone networks and or Wi-Fi back to servers at General Motors.
And General Motors then keeps that information in the course of normal business, correct?
That is correct.
Now, if someone buys a GM vehicle and they're not comfortable with uploading certain types of information, can they opt out of some of the things?
Certainly privacy, customer privacy is a big concern at General Motors, as you would expect. We've got lots of teams that look at that, investigate, and understand that. And we've got various protocols in place to protect the customer's privacy.
Okay. And let's speak generally again. What specific sorts of information is routinely uploaded from GM vehicles to GM servers?
It can be a lot of different pieces of information. Diagnostic trouble codes with your engines or brake systems. It could be information we upload. We monitor the performance of things like your battery to understand if your battery is getting low or needs some charging. And other pieces of information about what the vehicle may be doing. That can and does include, I would say, GPS information, your vehicle location, and potentially speed and things like that.
Okay. And that sort of information is kept by GM in the course of normal business, correct?
That's correct, sir.
And I'm going to draw your attention to March of last year. Are you aware, at least as of today, that SLED sent a search warrant to GM?
That's correct. I believe a search warrant was sent to General Motors to generally request information we may have about a particular vehicle.
All right. And I know you don't have the search warrant in front of you, but did you make a note of what a vehicle identification number or VIN that search warrant was requesting information for?
I do. I have that number here with me. I can read that.
Can you read that, please?
Yeah, VIN is a vehicle identification number that uniquely identifies the vehicle. It's a 17-character number. 1GNSKFKD0MR210998.
Let's fast forward to last Friday, which I believe was February 10th, if I looked at my calendar correctly. Did it come to your attention that even though that search warrant had been served back in March of last year, GM, in fact, had some information that was responsive to that original search warrant?
Yeah, that's correct. I wasn't necessarily involved in the search warrant back in March, but I did become aware Friday evening that additional information not previously given before existed.
All right. And so GM did, in fact, have some information on servers for that particular event, correct?
That's correct.
That had not been previously provided to law enforcement prior to last Friday, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
All right. And I'm going to show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 515-515.
John Conrad hands Mr. Newell a CD exhibit.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask if you recognize that.
Yes, that's correct. That's a CD with information on it that I reviewed on a laptop earlier today, and I've signed and dated the CD.
All right. And did you verify that the records contained on that CD is the information GM provided in response to that original March search warrant?
Yes, that's correct. I reviewed the three spreadsheets, Excel files that were on here, and those are, in fact, the same information that was stored in our databases and provided to you. And yes, I can authenticate that.
Okay. So those records contained on a CD are authentic copies of records maintained by GM in the normal course of business?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. And just briefly, what sorts of information is contained? And we're not going to ask you to go line by line or anything because there's a pretty voluminous amount of data, correct?
Yeah, there's three different Excel sheets, information collected over 3 days. Again, as I kind of talked, I have not reviewed the details of this. I'm not asked to analyze it.
Sure.
The form and content is what we get there. But generally speaking, that information includes, it says vehicle diagnostic information, information on the battery systems, and GPS information.
Okay, GPS information, including speed information?
That's correct. Longitude, latitude, speed information are included in there.
John Conrad concludes his direct examination of Mr. Newell. Defense Attorney Philip Barber rises to begin a short cross-examination of the witness.
Just have maybe 1 minute worth of questions. You weren't working on this when the search warrant came in, is that correct?
That's correct.
And you just became aware of this on Friday?
That's correct.
How did you become aware of it?
GM General Motors legal staff reached out to me in response to the subpoena as a person who could come down and authenticate these records.
The legal staff told you that you had information responsive to the search warrant?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm sorry, the General Motors had information responsive, not me
personally. I apologize for that. Of course, General Motors.
Thank you.
Are you aware of the testimony that occurred earlier in this case regarding reverse engineering the electronics in the Chevy Suburban?
I have general knowledge that some FBI folks have looked at some information inside of the infotainment system in the vehicle.
But do you have any knowledge of any reverse engineering efforts the FBI conducted over the course of a full year?
I have not been involved in those or not aware of any details of that, no, sir.
Maybe you can answer one quick technical question. The timestamps in this data, where do they come from?
I have not reviewed this specific data, but the timestamps out of these things here, when the GPS information is collected by a GPS receiver, included in that is timestamp information.
Okay. And then finally, this is information that was uploaded to a server at GM.
That's correct.
No further questions.
With that, Devin Newell steps down from the witness stand.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The prosecution next calls Roger Dale Davis to the witness stand. Mr. Davis, who goes by Dale, appears to be in his 40s or 50s. He is heavyset, sports a buzz cut with a graying stubble beard, and wears a loose-fitting long-sleeve gray t-shirt. Prosecutor David Fernandez handles the questioning for the state.
All right, Dale, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where were you born? Where were you raised?
I was born in Hampton County. I was raised in Hampton. Went to Wheat Hampton High School.
All right, what line of work do you have you done?
Construction work all my life.
Did you ever have an opportunity to work at the farm in Moselle?
Yes.
Okay. Is that close to where you actually live?
A mile and a half.
How did you become familiar with the Murdoch family and the Moselle property? How did you start working there?
I was walking, and Alex would stop and talk with me, and he asked me one day about cleaning the kennels for him, and probably a couple months, 6 months later, then he asked me to come do it on the weekends.
And that started about 4 years ago?
About 4 years ago.
And walk us through the process. What did you do? How many times a day did you do it?
Twice a day, once in the morning, once in the evening.
All right, what time in the morning, generally?
Average around 7.
You wake up early?
Oh, yeah.
So 7 a.m., and then what time in the evenings, generally?
Usually I try to get around 3:30, 4 o'clock.
How long does the process typically take you?
About 45 minutes.
And walk us through what that process is. What do you do out there?
In the morning times, I would go feed all the dogs, give them time to eat. I'd feed the chickens. That way the dogs would have time to eat. Then I'd wash the pens out. Then I would usually roll the hose up and then go to the house. And then come back in the afternoon and repeat the process.
Now you mentioned washing the pens out. Now the dogs, did they have dog beds in their kennels?
Grady and Bubba had two dog beds.
And if you're washing it out, meaning are you spraying it with water?
Spraying it with water.
What did you do with the dog beds?
I would stick them up on top of the dog box.
And then did you leave them up there or did you put them back?
Normally during the typically, once I washed the pens out, I would lay them back down, especially if it was cold in the wintertime, I would lay them back down on the ground. But during the summertime, you would wait that afternoon to lay them back down on the ground.
In the 4 years you worked there, did you get to know the property fairly well?
Yes.
Did you get to know the folks that lived there pretty well?
Yes.
Did you get to know Maggie Murdoch at all?
Yes, sir.
All right, well, tell us what your experiences with her were.
Normally, she was just so laid back. She would talk to you like a normal person. We'd sit down and talk about the dogs. She'd talk about sometimes where she would be at the beach. But she normally would tell me, you know, I'm going to the beach. I'm taking Bubba and Grady with me or whatnot, or I'm going to leave them. If it was real hot, she would want me to put them over there in the ice house, turn the air conditioner on where they have the ice. Oh, the cooler's at.
Did Maggie like to spend time with the dogs?
All the time.
When you mentioned the ice house, was that the processing house kind of on the back of the
property? That was the...
And why was it air-conditioned? Is that why you said she put them in there?
Yeah, and during the summertime, if it got real hot.
And that house, does it have air-conditioning, that shed?
Yes, sir.
All right, did you get to know Paul at all?
Yes.
All right, what was your experiences with him?
He was a little wild and crazy, but he would work. That boy would work.
He liked being at the farm?
He liked getting out and doing things, hunting, but he would work on the tractor or whatever that he needed him to do.
And did you get to know Alex?
I did.
Is he here today?
Yes, sir.
Where is he?
He's sitting right over there.
Do you explain what he's wearing?
Wearing a suit, a pair of glasses, blue-looking shirt.
Alex Murdoch appears to smile and nod at the witness.
And what were your experiences with Alex?
He was always very particular. He would want the dog buckets washed out. It looked like they started getting any kind of green or brown-looking stuff in the water. He wanted to make sure, which I usually washed them out every 2 weeks anyway, with bleach. But I always dunked them every day.
Was Alex easy to get a hold of?
No.
All right, explain that. What do you mean by that?
He would either be in court or doing something with business. It would sometimes be a little bit difficult to get a hold of him.
Who did you see most often when you were out there?
Miss Maggie or either Paul.
And how did Maggie and Paul typically come to and from the big house to the kennel area?
Paul would usually be in his truck.
We've heard a lot about trucks. Which truck was that?
His white F-150. Unless his daddy had him doing something, then he would have to drive the F-250. But most of the time, he'd be in his white F-150.
What color was the F-250?
It was also white.
So two white trucks were what he typically used?
Yes, sir.
And how about Maggie?
She normally drove her Range Rover until she got the black Mercedes.
And then what would she drive after that?
Most of the time, she would drive the black Mercedes.
Would she load her dogs, the house? First of all, let's go back. Which dogs were down there? Do you remember all the dogs?
Bubba, Grady, Maggie. Then they started letting, can't remember his name right. Dahlia was there, Armadillo, and I call her Tappy Toes. I don't know what they called her, but that's what I always called her.
And I think the other dog, was that a dog owned by one of Paul's friends, Rogan? Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes.
What type of dog was it?
A lab, chocolate lab.
And which dogs were the family dogs, the family pets?
Grady, Bubba, and Maggie.
And what kind of dogs were that?
Labs.
And colors?
Bubba was yellow, Grady was black, and Maggie was yellow.
And would they where would they typically stay, those dogs, those animals?
It all depended on, most of the time, because Bubba was very rambunctious, so they would got where they would lock him up in the kennels at night. And most of the time they would lock all the labs up in the kennels to keep them from roaming off. But Miss Maggie would take them out during, when she was home. Usually a lot of times after I done left, she would take them up to the house, let them roam around the yard for a couple hours, and then she would bring them back down to the pens.
And would Maggie load them into her car if she was taking them elsewhere to the beach or wherever else she was staying?
Wherever she was staying at, she would load them in the vehicle. Most times she would load them right in her vehicle.
I'm going to hand you what's been marked as State's Exhibits 505, 506, 502, 503, 504, and 516.
Prosecutor Fernandez hands the witness a stack of documents.
Dale, if you wouldn't mind, please take a moment to review all these and let me know if you recognize what they show.
They show the kennel.
Okay, and then I believe there's one diagram there, if you recognize what that shows.
It shows diagram drawing of the kennel.
Very good. What's been marked as State's Exhibit 505. Dale, while we get this loaded up, tell me a little bit. I know, did you have a particular way of hosing down and, you know, dealing with the hose? Tell us a little bit about what that was about.
Particular way of me putting the hose away or?
Right.
Normally after I got through washing, I would stretch the hose straight out.
Into which direction?
Back towards the shed room right there, the dog feed room.
A photo of a police cruiser outside the kennels is displayed on the monitor for Mr. Davis and the jury.
All right, and we now have the Elmo up. We're looking at Exhibit 505, and the feed room, I believe, is what you're referring to. Is that the structure on the far right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, and then where is in this picture, where is the hose you're talking about located?
It's back towards the left-hand side, back towards the forest end.
Is that that yellow?
That's that yellow, green-looking hose.
All right, go ahead and explain to us what you would typically do after rinsing off and putting the hose away.
I would stretch the hose out back towards the feed room. I would cut the valve off at the top, which is right up above as the hose come in. Then I would walk back down and cut the valve on at the end of the hose. That way it would release the pressure. And then I would roll it up slowly until I had it uniform.
Were you pretty particular about how you wound that hose?
Yes.
And why would you do it that way? And did you do it that way every time?
Every time.
And why would you do it so particularly?
Because if you notice how the hose right now is kinked up, it would start making the hose, where if you didn't do it right, eventually it would keep kinking. It would start making it where it didn't want to, and it would cause the hose to start having little splits in it.
The picture that you're seeing there, that hose, is that the way you would rewind it up?
No.
How do you know?
I'm very particular how I roll that hose up, and it's kinked up. If you notice, there's pressure on that hose. Somebody used that hose after I did, because it is twisted, and the nozzle is too far up. The nozzle, I would always have it made sure it was laid down flat. That nozzle is too far up.
Dale, I'm going to show you what's been marked as State's Exhibit 516.
Fernandez hands the witness another document.
And again, please briefly explain what it is we're looking at there.
The drawing of the kennel.
Okay. Did you work the, were you aware of the events surrounding June 7th, 2021, where Maggie and Paul were murdered?
I received a phone call from CD that Slim wanted to see me because Ms. Maggie and Paul had been murdered. And I thought he was joking, but he told me no. I told him, give me 5 minutes. I'd be up there because I was going to carry my trash off at the time. And I got up there, and the dogs was raising Cain. And I asked him, could I go ahead and feed the dogs so they would quiet down? And they told me to give them a few minutes, and then they gave me permission to feed them. And as soon as I fed them, they just quiet down. They barked no more.
So you were familiar about that incident?
Yes, sir.
And you went out there what day?
That morning.
Is that the 8th of the morning of Tuesday?
When the murders happened, yes.
Did you work every day leading up to that day?
Yes.
And did you do that normal routine which you already described?
Yes.
All right, and did you in fact do that normal routine on the Monday of the before the murders?
Yes.
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, the trial of Alex Murdoch. Please join us on our next installment as we conclude our review of the testimony of Roger Dale Davis. Also, check out the Ambie-nominated crime story podcast, Night Raid, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty crime story Patreon page.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie Antholis. It was co-produced, written, and edited by yours truly, Chris Terracone. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Trial audio is courtesy of Law & Crime Networks. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.